Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we've got a bang-up, fun-filled episode. I mean, the house is full, the lines are jammed. I don't know how to say this. We've got more people on this call than I think we've ever had before, and we're probably going to get two episodes out of what we discussed tonight. So without further ado, I need to jump right in to the head cat wrangler for the evening.
Sam, yeah, well, wrangling James Corbin. I told David I was going to corral him, and he said he was uncorralable. So we were lucky to get him because he's on the way to Africa again, which we'll talk about in a minute. But we do have a very full house besides me and Jamie. There's Dr. Joe. Hi, Dr. Joe.
Hey, guys. Glad to be here. Just got back from Hurricane Laura.
And we're going to talk about that, too. And then our meteorologists, both of them, Kyle and Becky. Hi, Kyle and Becky. Say hi.
Hi.
Hey, Sam.
And our two guests, they've been on with us before talking about wilderness medicine, but I'm going to save them so we can get, you know, a little more detail on what they do. And, oh, my God, the Sasquatch. He actually appeared, and he's here with us, Jim Logan. Joe Hawley's partner. We are so glad to have him. So we are definitely going to have a lively discussion tonight. But first, we first want to talk about the after effects of Hurricane Laura, and then we'll talk a bit about what else is coming because it still hasn't slowed down much. So, Kyle, you want to start?
Heck yes, Sam. Glad to have everyone on the podcast with us tonight, both hosting and listening. Happy National Preparedness Month. That is September. And yes, the aftermath of Hurricane Laura, the cleanup along the Gulf Coast does continue with power restoration, restoring of water and wastewater infrastructure, and sheltering of survivors, responders, and restoration crews still ongoing, in addition to supporting healthcare facilities and debris removal so that those communities can continue to respond and transition into recovery. Looking across Louisiana and Texas, several tens of thousands of survivors still in both congregate and non-congregate shelters. Latest numbers from the feds are showing 17 confirmed fatalities in Louisiana, none in Texas, very thankfully, and several hospitals still remaining evacuated to this day, and over 150,000 still without power. And in the wake of Hurricane Laura, as Joe hinted at in his introduction, he has since demobilized from his deployment down to Hurricane Laura there in Louisiana with the Urban Search and Rescue's incident support team. And we talked about that quite a lot last week, which was a ton of fun. And lots of federal resources still there, along with state and local resources supporting that communities, all the local communities, so the parishes, and all the way to the state level, their response and their transition to recovery.
Thank you, sir. So Becky, and I joke and reflect on this as well, we didn't get, you know, watching the Weather Channel, they're talking about this 15-foot storm surge, which fortunately didn't occur. What do you think happened there?
You know, it's a good question. I think we're all thankful that the storm surge didn't, you know, fully verify as what it was potentially anticipated to be. However, Laura was an extremely damaging storm from the wind standpoint, from the rainfall standpoint, and certainly along the immediate coast, particularly where the storm made landfall. The storm surge was very, very damaging, and it did go a few miles inland. Thankfully, not as far inland as we, you know, potentially anticipated. But I think the main story ended up being with Laura, you know, except for along the immediate coast where that storm surge was impactful, was the wind. Lake Charles saw wind gusts, peak wind gusts of 132 miles per hour, pretty consistently along the coast, 80, 90 rainfall, around 7 to 8 inches. Church Point saw 8.28 inches. But I think overall, Laura didn't have quite as devastating of an impact as it potentially could have. That's certainly a good thing. I don't know that I have a great explanation for why that is. But overall, I think Joe more than anything could attest to what the experience is like on the ground. I think there's still a lot of damage, a lot of recovery to be done there on the Louisiana coast.
So, Kyle, back to you, and then I have another question for Becky. How about where that track that it took up to the east? How did that work out?
Well, Sam, after Laura made landfall and progressed north through Louisiana and up and through Arkansas, dumping incredible amounts of rain, I know both Louisiana, all of Louisiana, all of Arkansas, and some of the most eastern counties in Texas were all approved for federal disaster declarations for funding to support immediate mass care and life safety operations. And so definitely a testament to the widespread impact of this storm. I know the coast gets a lot of the attention, but the inland flooding is definitely a major hazard and a major, at least to several cascading hazards as well. But as that after Laura made landfall, tracked very close to, as was forecast, off to the north and east. And once it got through Arkansas, it got picked up by the jet stream and pushed very, very quickly off to the east. So thankfully not producing as heavy rain as it progressed quickly towards the east coast, and then just off, and it continues to just kind of spiral out there. And so thankfully the damage was largely contained to the south central U.S.
Yeah, beautiful. So Becky, what else is brewing out there?
Unfortunately, a lot of things. If you take a look at the NHC page, the National Hurricane Center, the five-day outlook, there are currently three areas of concern that could potentially impact the U.S., of course, way, way down the road. Give it like a week and a half. I think we're still going to be in a fairly quiet period. We did have tropical storm. Actually, I think it was Hurricane Nana made landfall near Belize about 24 hours ago, maybe earlier this morning. Days kind of run together now. But there are certainly some areas of development the National Hurricane Center is monitoring. So certainly do not let your guard down. As Kyle said, it is preparedness month. We're still in peak hurricane season. So there's certainly still a chance here in the next probably 2 to 3 weeks for there to be an impacting storm for the U.S. Not a guarantee, but certainly do not let your guard down.
Yeah, I was looking at one of your tweets, and when I do, I get all the other meteorologists in their comments, and one of them had a graphic, and then his title was Screams. So I thought, well, that can't be good. I don't know what it is, but if he thinks it's that bad. So I thought, oh, what's coming up? So Dr. Joe, Tennessee got a bit wet while you were out playing in Louisiana, didn't it?
It did indeed. We had a good deployment to Louisiana. I think Kyle talked about a lot of that sort of stuff. Thankfully, not as many, you know, deaths, et cetera, as were thought there might be. And certainly lots of the storm surge, I think, turned out not to be as bad as thought. So thankfully that whole system wasn't quite as terrible as anticipated.
Well, tell us a little bit about, you know, we mentioned last week, if you listened, he's with the incident support team, and assuming you were going to be involved in water rescues, which fortunately wasn't a big thing, but what else did you do there, Joe?
Well, I think a lot of what this one was about, you know, a lot more structural stuff, a lot less in the way of, you know, actual water rescue. Which turned out to be good, all done in a COVID-heavy environment. So, you know, very interesting set of challenges there for sure. Interestingly enough, the majority of, not the majority, but a significant number of the deaths from that storm were not directly related to the storm. There were 7 deaths from carbon monoxide poisoning from people putting their generators inside their homes and leading to death there. So
you would think people would know better by now. what else? I had another question for you, Joe, and I'm losing my mind here. You mentioned COVID. As a side note, I guess there's a lot of concern about Labor Day weekend, which we're in, and people running amok on the beach and not wearing masks and so forth. What have you heard about that?
Well, I think it's a definite cause for concern. You know, there's no question that these it seems one of the big spreaders right now has to do with sort of family and social events, much more so than work-related stuff. I think people tend to let their guard down and try to relax and enjoy, you know, a little social time. And unfortunately, that stuff turns out to be really bad. So I expect we'll see a little spike up over the Labor Day holiday.
Yeah, I saw something that even recommended wearing masks with family if it's not someone you're actually living in. Kyle just mentioned heat wave, wildfires, closed beaches, rolling blackouts, Labor Day weekend can be bad, especially in California. That totally makes sense. Well, then, we will move on to our guests. Mr. James, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
It's quiet.
I think everybody else is here.
Mr. James Corbin has been a regular guest. He's our world traveler, and he's heading back to Africa at the end of the month. So we wanted to catch him before he went away into parts unknown. Mr. Corbin, you want to tell folks a little bit about you and what you do and where you go and so forth?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a physician assistant doing primarily emergency medicine right now in Arizona, getting ready in about 3 weeks to head over to Senegal, which is in West Africa. But before I was in PA, I was an EMT and then a paramedic. I still keep my patch. It's one of the things I'm actually the most proud of, and have done backcountry medicine and wilderness medicine in Virginia and Arizona. I lived for a year in Micronesia, did dive medicine and some inter-island rescue there, and have already done one stint in Africa, and so been kicked around. And just generally love practicing medicine and in challenging and remote places, is, I guess, the business card version.
Well, you certainly do. I'm just wondering, you have kids, right? So it's probably an interesting experience for them that they'll carry through their adulthood in having interacted with all these different people in these different parts of the world.
Yeah, and it's actually one of the main drivers for us to decide that, you know, that this was something we wanted to do. Paul Watson, who was the guy who took IBM from kind of a calculator company to the global powerhouse that it is today, his famous line was, "The problem with Americans is they think like Americans." And you know, it's we're excited to raise global citizens who sort of think past their the traditional boundaries. And I think, you know, more and more what we're seeing is that that's what we need in this day and age.
Agreed. And lately, with some of the things going on, you kind of realize how much they take for granted. And your kids will be much more well-rounded, I think. David Brumson, you want to introduce yourself?
Yes, ma'am. David Brumson, and I've known Mr. Corbin for a number of years. And my background and relevant to today's discussion, I've been with our mountain rescue team since June of 97. So a couple years down my belt, came on the team and discovered this group of what we call square diamonds, which I'll get into a little bit later as we discuss this. And spent a number of years running training and as the team commander. And then I have my own gig to pay the bills where I provide personal security and defense training to people. And essentially, unfortunately, I have to say it, my business is all about people dealing with violence. So it brings up some interesting cocktail party discussions, there's no doubt.
Yeah, and unfortunately, even for EMS providers, that's become more of a way of life. And we'll maybe touch on that too. So
yeah.
We kind of wanted to look at two topics with you guys, kind of focusing on the wilderness EMS part. And let's hit the dealing with volunteers. And just to remind the group in this room, if you have a question or a comment, hit the sidebar so I can make sure I acknowledge everybody if they have a question or a comment. So let's talk about that. We're just going to let you take a dive into it, and since you're up, we'll have you start, David.
Yeah.
How do you deal with volunteers?
How do you deal with volunteers? In a volunteer organization, you don't have the power of the paycheck, which can, you know, that carrot of financial gain and being able to put a roof over your head and all that, there's definitely some leverage in that and compelling people to do what they need to do. However, as we all know, you know, those that have been involved in volunteer organizations, intrinsic paychecks pay dividends down the road. As I mentioned, I first joined our mountain rescue team in 1997. It was just a few years after I got out of the military, getting into this organization. And my initial observation was, and it was put to me, and so I stole this term, but it was a group of square diamonds. And essentially, as individuals, they were outstanding. You know, each person was very talented. There was a lot of experience. That just really good people, but in a team environment, which mountain rescue is very much a team sport, they were horrible. I mean, to the point where I showed up to one of my first trainings and there was a fist fight. And there were other, yeah, it was over, you know, how many angels can you fit on the head of the pin? And there was, and I'm thinking, wow, this is not exactly what I envisioned. And next thing you know, I fell into a position where I was now, within about a year, I was within the leadership of the team, and I said, this just cannot continue. So rallied some like-minded folks, and we conducted, and I know this sounds callous, but we conducted what we called the Night of the Long Knives, and we put in team standards, so individual standards that pertain to the team that were at an extremely high level with two intentions. One was to filter out all of the old folks that couldn't really pull their weight anymore. And the other intent was to ensure that the people that we brought on the team were the very, very best, and we wanted to build an elite organization, knowing that people want to be a part of groups that other people can't be a part of for whatever reason, you know, because of the requirements. And as we moved down the road, we found that our service was better, our product was better, our team dynamic was outstanding. We had a zero Adam Henry, or, you know, zero troublemaker culture, where we just wouldn't even let them in. And so it developed into a team and continues today that's does what they do probably better than any team I've ever seen, whether paid, sworn, and even rivals the teams that I was on when I was in the military, working, you know, at a fairly high level. So that's the humongous nutshell of how we changed our organization and working with volunteers. So, you know, just to summarize, you build an organization that people want to be a part of. They'll put everything into it. They'll sacrifice a lot to help out their teammates and to perpetuate that positive culture and that feeling of satisfaction that you get of being a part of an elite organization.
Excellent. So you mentioned sworn. Joe, you and I, both on our respective federal teams, find that to be the case. We have a lot of team level as well as national level standards, you know, because there's so many different people. And let's talk about it. We're dealing with A-level, A-type personalities. So it's like, you know, herding cats, basically. So what do you think, Joe?
Well, I think that's very true. You know, and I think an even bigger challenge is for most of these kind of responses, it's often a multitude of agencies that are responding. and there tends to be significant differences in that team, whatever the word is there, you know, how that team responds. And so you may have one team that's very type A, very aggressive, very go after it, another team that's very low key, and the mesh is very difficult. Oftentimes that's the difference between sort of professionals and amateurs or volunteers. And it really does make for some incredibly difficult and challenging circumstances.
You know, this reminds me of Ground Zero, because there was only 16 of us that went as a team. But everybody had their own anxiety and their own issues, and there were some serious problems of people wanting to go off on their own and do things on their own. And there's actually a few funny stories behind that, but we don't have time for that now. Jamie, I want to throw this to you, because you worked in the volunteer environment. How do you think that's different now? Are volunteer teams losing volunteers because of COVID? Because there isn't a paycheck?
Yeah. I mean, every hurdle that comes up in a volunteer system is another potential point where more volunteers say this is too much. So there, you know, there've always been training hurdles in the EMS and fire systems that have volunteer services, and that includes rescue services too. And at some point there are people who think it's great, but then when they look at the amount of training involved and the amount of regular ongoing training involved, they realize that the commitment is more than they're anticipating. So that's always been a hot point. But now you add in COVID, and that becomes another issue. You add in, you know, fill in the blank. Any hurdle that they have to jump over, a certain number of people just decide they just don't want to jump it, and they bow out. And so it is a constant effort on the behalf of the leadership to maintain some kind of carrot, something to keep the people motivated. It can be esprit de corps. You know, a certain level of pride in doing a job well done. It can be a fellowship situation where people are just great to hang around, and there's lots of opportunities to just, you know, come and be around each other and have a good time in between the responses and things. You know, there's lots of different ways to do that. But it ultimately, every kind of thing that comes up becomes a potential issue that separates volunteers from the system.
Very true. Nicely said. So, Mr. Corbin, I think it was you that made the comment about we're going to be needing volunteers in the future. You want to reflect on that? Are we thinking COVID and vaccines and that kind of thing?
Yeah, this country's medical response and emergency response really started from volunteers. So if you go over to Europe, if you go over to a lot of countries, there is a organized paid, like you can be a paid search and rescue professional in Europe, you can be a paid search and rescue professional in, you know, a lot of parts of Asia, and a lot of parts of the world, the military handles this. Dr. Joe could probably speak to this, but this country has always relied on volunteers to do backcountry rescue, wilderness rescue, search and rescue. I would wager the number of dog teams in this country, there are very few that are, they're associated with law enforcement. And the paid search and rescue job is the unicorn. And David and I both know a few folks who have gotten those positions, and they're exalted. Everyone, it's like winning the lottery, although both of them worked quite hard and are excellent at what they do. So that's it. You have to have folks that are willing to, and this is different than joining your local hiking club or, you know, the benevolent society. You have to have people that are excited about getting up at 2 a.m. and driving for 3 hours and hiking for, 4 hours in the rain, only to realize the person you're looking for actually was at the bar the whole time. right? Like, you have to be okay with that. And those aren't normal people. So we're not just talking about managing volunteers. We're talking about managing volunteers with probably serious judgment issues.
You know, you remind me of my ski patrol career, and there was always, on the coldest day of the year, there was always that guy that nobody could find. And, you know, so we'd have to stay there and gear up in our already wet clothing and, you know, and go look for the guy. And then sure enough, he's back at his cabin or he's in the bar. So I totally relate. Kyle, you got to be able to relate to this.
I do, Sam, on many levels. I actually started my career in public safety and emergency management as a volunteer back in Michigan with amateur radio and on ski patrol as well. And so that's all the comments made so far. It definitely jives, and it is true. There are very few paid mountain rescue, search and rescue organizations. And I mean, we here in Aspen, we're very fortunate to have a very highly trained, very highly qualified team. But they, you know, as was hinted at, right, it's very refined. You have dedicated volunteers, a very good management structure, a training program in place, and very well-documented policies and procedures so that, yes, we do have a lot of type A personalities as any type of public safety or, you know, type of public service team would have, but we're governed, we're expected to follow those rules, and it really helps to bring everyone together so that we are all reading from the same sheet of music and operating in a consistent manner.
Becky, are meteorologists a good team, or do you work more or less independently?
That's a good question. No, meteorology is a very collaborative science. So even though, you know, I think a lot of teams are working somewhat remotely right now, there's still a huge amount of collaboration that goes on. So at least for us, we have a, you know, persistent video chat up all the time. So we're constantly talking and in touch. But even still, I think you lose some of the just sort of natural collaboration that comes out from being in person. So unfortunately, I think the impact of COVID is going to be pretty widespread. And, you know, it's day-to-day things. You may not even realize it's impacting, but it certainly is.
And I would just jump in only because Kyle mentioned it. There is a phenomenal book that was written on the Aspen Mountain Rescue Team. It's out of print now, I think. It's called The Falling Season. And I only know about it because David put it on. We had a required reading list for the mountain rescue team that I joined when he was the commander. It's very well written, but it was a reporter, I think, for one of the Colorado papers that basically shadowed the team for a year.
Wow.
And it just happened that it was the exact same year that they instituted the ICS system. And there was this huge battle and huge administrative fight and all sorts of hurt. It's very well documented. And, you know, it's funny because you read that book now and you keep looking at the back cover thinking, wait, is this about my team? This seems like it's about my team. The author was Hal Clifford. I would guess he's still kicking around. He would be a great guest because it's really, I mean, he really sort of bathed in those waters. But I mean, this is such an old story, and everyone has a tale to spin about it. So it's, you know, we've almost identified the problem. We just don't know how to solve it.
So what's the name of that book again, and the author?
It's called The Falling Season, and the author is Hal Clifford.
Hmm. Yeah, I'd be interested. I don't know where you would find it, but
You can get old copies on Amazon. They're not
too
expensive.
Still.
I'm sure Kyle will be looking for it. He's already found it. He's popped it up on the sidebar on Amazon. Perfect. Yeah, that would be interesting. I'd love to get people like that as a guest. So, Dave, question for you. One thing I remember, you're talking about the lack of paycheck for volunteers, but one thing National Ski Patrol was really good about was awards. I mean, they gave away so many awards that it got redundant sometimes, but it was their way of acknowledging, you know, you talk about, you know, that lost guy at the end of the day and having to go out there in the cold when you're starving and want dinner. And, you know, it's recognizing people for the effort that they put in, or the extra effort they put in when they're in certain roles. I imagine that makes a big difference. It just certainly did for me.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that, and then you mentioned the overabundance of awards, and it's funny, when I was in the military, we would laugh at sometime, you know, when people received a certain awards, or ourselves received an award. But then in Mountain Rescue, on our team, we did have an award system in place, but all the awards were peer generated. So all of them except for one. So it was a vote of confidence by your peers. And we called it I hate to pat myself on the back, but it was the Rescue Mountaineer of the Year award. And I instituted that when I was commander, so that the team voted on who they thought did the work that year and really, really shined. And it was very competitive because it meant a lot, because it came from your peers. It didn't come from an outside organization. It didn't come from the sheriff's office. It didn't come from anybody. You know, the people that really just didn't matter to us. Again, we built this culture where our peers were what mattered, and our teammates. And then we had an additional award that I brought in called the Commander's Award. So that was somebody that, you know, whomever's commander at the time looked at from their position as being the significant contributor to the team. And that could be someone that's, you know, that quiet person that's kind of behind the scenes doing things or whatever. And again, highly regarded because it meant something. It came from someone that you respected. And so, yeah, absolutely, those awards were very powerful.
And that's going to wrap up this episode of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we're going to let folks sign off. The episode that we recorded today actually went into a second half episode with the same guest, so come back next week for that with everybody we had on the show tonight. And I will just sign off and thank everybody first by saying thank you to Paragon Medical Education Group for their continued support of the Disaster Podcast with everything that they do. Check them out at paragonmedicalgroup.com, at Paragon Medical Group on Facebook, and Paragon Med EDU on Twitter, where you can find some of the best and most customizable training solutions for your organization. They help you work within your budget. So reach out to them and just ask for a conversation. I think you're going to be very surprised and pleased with what you find is available for you when the time comes to bring that unique training evolution to your group. That's it for us. I'm Jamie Davis here on behalf of the entire team here at the Disaster Podcast. And just want to remind you that, when you've got volunteers in the response community, disaster volunteers aren't your everyday volunteers.